Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Humanitarians have expressed deep concern at crisis levels of hunger in Yemen after the release of new food security assessments in the war-torn country on Wednesday. According to the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, analysis by UN agencies, 3.2 million people will likely be in dire need in the next 6 months, up from 2 million now. Last year, famine was avoided thanks to a massive scale-up of humanitarian assistance, but escalating conflict and, above all, the economic meltdown in the Arabian state have caused rising food prices and a near-total depletion of foreign exchange reserves. In a statement, UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Yemen, Lise Grande, said that disaster will only be avoided if funding is provided now. In addition to a new wave of violence in Al-Jawf and Marib, the resilience of war-weary Yemenis has been hit by flash floods, desert locusts, and fall armyworm infestations. At least 40 million children worldwide are not receiving preschool education owing to closures linked to the coronavirus pandemic, UN child experts have said. Spearheading the alert, the head of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, warned that COVID-19 is making a global childcare crisis even worse. According to the UN Children's Fund research, shutdowns of childcare and early learning centres have also left many parents struggling to look after their children and earn a living. The situation is placing a larger burden on women, who spend more than three times longer on care and housework than men, the UN agency noted. The study shows that in 54 low- and middle-income countries, around 40% of 3 to 5-year-olds were not receiving social, emotional, and cognitive stimulation from any adult in their household. For millions of parents, and especially women working in the informal sector who have no welfare protection, their only option is to take their children to work. UNICEF says that more than 90% of women in Africa and almost 70% in Asia and the Pacific work informally. To Tanzania, finally, which has been urged to heed international calls to allow peaceful gatherings to take place ahead of elections later this year and step back from laws described as draconian. In their appeal on Wednesday, three UN-appointed independent rights experts, known as special rapporteurs, also maintained that the government was not being transparent enough after it stopped releasing statistics on COVID-19 cases. They cited the amended Basic Rights and Duties Enforcement Act, which will ultimately prevent organizations from filing cases on behalf of victims of rights abuses. In a statement, the special rapporteurs warned that the changes had been fast-tracked through Parliament and were just the latest in a string of newly enacted draconian legislation. It was being used to intimidate activists, silence journalists, and further restrict freedom of expression, peaceful assembly and association, insisted special rapporteurs Clement Voul, Mary Lawler, and David Kay. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take the entire hour to speak with Professor Marjorie Cohn. In addition to the health pandemic and the economic disaster, Trump has escalated his attacks on both democracy and the rule of law.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Without democracy and the rule of law, there can be no significant social change. However much democracy was constricted by race and class before the events of September 11th and before Trump, democracy and the rule of law now are facing lethal attacks on many fronts. Trump has successfully put 198 young reactionary and in some cases ignorant judges on the federal bench. He has illegally called out troops to violently disperse peaceful protesters in the park in front of the White House. Trump has threatened the personnel of the International Criminal Court who are attempting to investigate U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. These include the crime of torture. These crimes perpetrated under the Bush administration were unprosecuted by President Obama, who infamously said, "We must look forward, not backward." Trump's Justice Department is pursuing and attempting to extradite truth-telling, whistleblowing journalist Julian Assange, who 10 years ago released the collateral murder video showing the commission of American war crimes in Iraq, among other embarrassing information. Assange is confined in London's Belmarsh prison. He is sick, in solitary and has been psychologically tortured. He faces 175 years in prison if convicted under the old Espionage Act for activities protected by the First Amendment. We speak today about these attacks on democracy and the rule of law with attorney Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for 25 years. She was a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, a criminal defense attorney, a legal scholar, and a political analyst. She writes books and articles and lectures throughout the world about human rights, U.S. foreign policy, and the connection between the two. She has testified before Congress and spoken at the prestigious Oxford Union. Attorney Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Marjorie, bring us up to date on the Julian Assange case. I recently read that he was too sick to appear in court at his own extradition hearing.
Yes. Well, in May, he was unable to attend via video link because of illness and advice from his doctors. He's particularly vulnerable. He's in prison. He's in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. And then the other hour that he's allowed to exercise, he's packed in with, I think, 40 other inmates in close proximity. And he has pre-existing health conditions thanks to the UK's denial of medical care for him while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy under a grant of asylum in London. And he has serious respiratory issues and other serious health conditions that make him particularly vulnerable. Eight Australian MPs, four senators, and a number of members of Australia's legislature urged that Assange be released on bail. They said that the extradition hearings have been disrupted and delayed, leaving Mr. Assange unable to have his case heard until September at the earliest, while deaths within the UK prison population and illness among judicial and penal staff cohorts continue to rise. Now, Michael, Assange's full extradition hearing is set to take place on September 7th, even though they don't have a Crown Court yet. And in June, actually the 29th of this month, there's going to be another administrative hearing where psychiatric reports will be introduced by the prosecution and the defense. Assange's lawyers have not had adequate access to their clients, and journalists have also had a hard time covering the case because of barely audible phone links to the administrative hearings. So that's what's happening. His extradition hearing started in February, continued in May, and is scheduled to be completed in September.
Julian Assange is an Australian citizen who was working in London. How can the United States presume to have jurisdiction over him?
Well, the United States, under Trump, indicted Julian Assange under the Espionage Act, and he's facing 175 years in the U.S. if convicted. And the Trump administration wants the U.K. court to extradite Assange to the United States to face charges. So the issue, and of course, if he was extradited to the United States, then the U.S. would assume jurisdiction over him. And the issue of whether the U.K. should extradite him is the issue that's pending in the U.K. court.
Isn't it true that Obama would not charge him and try to get him extradited, that Trump made a policy decision changing that?
Yes, absolutely. The Obama administration refrained from indicting Assange for fear of establishing, quote, a precedent that could chill investigative reporting about national security matters by treating it as a crime, unquote. And that's a quote from Charlie Savage of the New York Times. Obama's government had difficulty distinguishing between what WikiLeaks did in revealing the war crimes that the U.S. had committed and what traditional news media organizations like the New York Times do, a according to Charlie Savage, in soliciting and publishing information they obtain that the government wants to keep secret, unquote. And news organizations, including The Times, published articles that drew on documents WikiLeaks had published in 2010, including logs of significant combat events in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And those war crimes that WikiLeaks published included the infamous collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army helicopter executing several people in cold blood, including a journalist, and then committing other war crimes by firing on the people rescuing them and then cutting a body in half in violation of the Geneva Convention. So it was very newsworthy what WikiLeaks revealed, and other news organizations picked up as well. But no, the Obama administration made a strategic decision not to indict Assange, but those considerations didn't stop the Trump administration from going ahead and indicting him under the Espionage Act.
Shouldn't Assange be exempt under our First Amendment as a journalist? Don't we have the right to know the product of his journalism?
Absolutely. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, said, "We have to recognize that we can no longer allow Assange and his colleagues the latitude to use free speech values against us. Julian Assange has no First Amendment privileges. He's not a U.S. citizen," unquote. That's from Mike Pompeo. But the Supreme Court has long held that the Constitution applies to non-Americans, not just U.S. citizens. If Julian Assange were to come to the United States, he would have the constitutional rights that Americans enjoy as well. He would have First Amendment rights, and, of course, freedom of the press is right in the middle of the First Amendment.
Yeah, but they ignore that. They I think it was Pompeo that said WikiLeaks is a non-state intelligence service.
Well, you know, the Trump administration has a way of branding anyone who threatens them or opposes their policies, including, like, branding white allies of the Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, as Antifa, anti-fascist. There is no such organization called Antifa. And Trump is, of course, notorious in pulling out labels, and this is one example of that.
Yeah, I read that. Antifa is about as amorphous as all those people who don't like the Dave Matthews Band. Marjorie Cohen, let me ask you this. The USA and Great Britain have a non-extradition treaty for political offenses. The United States is arguing that the treaty doesn't apply to Julian Assange. They also argue that espionage is not a political crime. That's weird to me because it seems that it's a political crime by definition. And the third defense that the United States is putting up in support of what it's trying to do is that the USA argues that there's no public interest defense allowed in espionage cases. Is the USA going to be able to get away with any of these three arguments?
Well, the 2003 extradition treaty between the U.S. and the U.K. states extradition shall not be granted if the offense for which extradition is requested is a political offense. And it would be the U.K. that would determine whether or not the request by the U.S. was politically motivated. Now, there's no clear definition of what a political offense is, but it routinely includes treason, sedition, and espionage, and offenses directed against state power. And Assange published true information obtained from Chelsea Manning, a whistleblower, making the charges against him political in nature. The political nature of his extradition process is clear, and Baltasar Garzon, who coordinates Assange's legal team, said that if the country that required extradition were not the United States, it's absolutely certain that the issue of extradition would not even be considered in court. Extradition against Julian Assange has a clear political focus, and we will be able to prove it without any reasonable doubt. Now, there is, I think that the U.S. has raised this supplementary extradition treaty between the U.S. and the U.K. that was concluded in 2006, and it lists crimes that are excluded from the political offense exception. And remember, political offense would keep him from being extradited. And so the crimes that are excluded from this political offense exception are terrorism and other crimes of violence. But the new treaty, the 2006 supplementary treaty between the U.S. and the U.K., prohibits extradition where the U.K. would determine that the request was politically motivated. And the determination of a claim of political motivation is distinct from the determination of the application of the political offense exception. And here, there's clearly a political motivation in the Trump administration going after Julian Assange, and that's been clear from statements that the administration has made, and also concerns that WikiLeaks might publish additional information that is embarrassing to the Trump administration.
Hasn't the judge that's presiding over this already tipped her hand on how she's going to rule against Assange?
Yes, she has. In fact, when Julian Assange's lawyers asked her to release Julian Assange on bail because, as I said, his health conditions make him particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus, and if he got it because of his severe lung disease, he would not fare well from the virus. And she said it's extremely likely, I don't remember her exact words, but she basically tipped her hand, it's very likely that he will be extradited to the United States, which judges are not supposed to be tipping their hands about decisions, you know, judicial decisions, but she did tip her hand there, assuming that she's the one who ultimately makes the determination about extradition, or if she has inside information about what other UK judges might do. It seems like that's the direction that it's headed. The extradition request by the Trump administration will likely be granted. He'll be sent to the United States for trial under this indictment, and he will be in great jeopardy if he gets to the United States, likely be tortured. There's also a convention against torture, which we've ratified. It's a treaty saying that if there's a substantial likelihood that someone might be tortured, they should not be sent to that country. And since Chelsea Manning was tortured, likely tortured according to the UN Special Rapporteur by being held in solitary confinement for 11 months and then being stripped naked for inspection, it's likely that if Assange was sent to the United States, was extradited to the United States, he well might be subjected to torture. So there's another reason he should not be extradited to the United States.
So Marjorie Cohen, what's at stake here? If the Trump administration is successful, will it kill national security journalism?
I don't think it'll kill national security journalism, but it will certainly chill journalists who are reporting on national security matters. And in fact, that quote from Charlie Savage was very prescient because he was talking about why Obama did not indict Julian Assange for fear of establishing a precedent that could chill investigative reporting about national security matters by treating it as a crime. And that's what we're facing, a real clear threat to the First Amendment freedom of the press.
So how can our listeners follow this case and give support? Is there a website?
There are two. There's first defend.wikileaks.org. That's defend.wikileaks.org. And in the UK, there's another website, don'textraditeassange.org. That's don'textraditeassange.org.
And you and I have been working on establishing a American Defense Committee, and we've secured the support of Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, and Alice Walker, who are going to be the honorary co-heads. So I advise our listeners to keep paying attention because we're going to soon launch that national committee. Let me ask you about a related question on the destruction of the rule of law. Let's talk about the Trump administration's sabotage of international law. They recently tried to bully the International Criminal Court into dropping its war crimes probe into the USA's activities in Afghanistan and Iraq. What crimes is the International Criminal Court looking into?
they're looking into crimes against humanity and war crimes committed by the CIA and the U.S. military in Afghanistan, including torture and cruel treatment and outrages upon personal dignity, as well as rape and other forms of sexual violence against those held in detention facilities in the territory of parties to the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. That includes Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. And the prosecutor, the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, of the International Criminal Court, found that these alleged crimes were not the abuses of a few isolated individuals, but were part of approved interrogation techniques in an attempt to extract actionable intelligence from detainees. And she found reason to believe that crimes were committed in the furtherance of a policy or policies which would support U.S. objectives in the conflict in Afghanistan.
So there are personnel from the International Criminal Court that are investigating, and the United States is bullying them. What kind of bullying? What does it consist of?
Well, the bullying, the Trump administration threatened to ban judges and prosecutors from the ICC, the International Criminal Court, ban them from the United States, and warned that it would impose economic sanctions on the court if it launched an investigation. And last year, the U.S. revoked Bensouda's visa to come to the United States, to come to the U.N. She's the chief prosecutor. Mike Pompeo said, "The U.S. is not a party to the ICC, and we will take all necessary measures to protect our citizens from this renegade so-called court." Well, even if a country is not a party to the Rome Statute, its nationals can still be tried in the ICC if the crimes took place in the territory of a country that is a party. So although the U.S. has not ratified the Rome Statute, the ICC still has jurisdiction over crimes committed by U.S. nationals in the territory of Afghanistan. And when Pompeo said we will take all necessary measures, he was likely referring to the American Service Members Protection Act, which was enacted during the Bush administration after it removed the U.S. signature from the Rome Statute. And that American Service Members Protection Act contains a clause called the Hague Invasion Act. And it says that if a U.S. or allied national is detained by the ICC, the U.S. military can use armed force to extricate the individual. Now, although this Hague Invasion Act has not yet been used, the potential for its use, as you can imagine, is frightening.
Yeah, it's plenty scary. The United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court. Why is that?
Well, as Clinton was leaving office, he signed the Rome Statute. And when a country signs a treaty, that indicates an intent to ratify, and he wanted to continue to that the U.S. continued to be involved in the negotiations over the Rome Statute. But in order to become a party to a treaty, the president has to go to the Senate and get two-thirds consent, advice and consent of the Senate to ratification, and then the president ratifies the treaty. Well, not only did Clinton put the U.S. signature on the treaty, but he advised George W. Bush not to send it to the Senate for ratification. It probably wouldn't have been ratified anyway. So not only didn't Bush send the treaty, the Rome Statute, to the Senate for advice and consent to ratification, he actually removed the U.S. signature from the treaty. It's unprecedented. Unsigned the treaty. So the U.S., as a consequence, is not only not a party to the treaty, it's not a signatory either.
Yeah, it's chilling when you think about how many countries around the world are members of the treaty. They have signed the treaty. The United States kind of stands out as this international bully that doesn't want to cooperate. But let me ask you this, Marjorie. Why did the bullying of the United States fail? I mean, the ICC is going forward in its investigation, isn't it?
Well, yes. After the U.S. threats in April of last year, the ICC's pretrial chamber refused to authorize the investigation that the prosecutor had requested. But in an unprecedented decision, the appeals chamber unanimously overruled the pretrial chamber in March of this year and ordered a formal investigation of U.S., Afghan, and Taliban officials for crimes including torture committed in the so-called war on terror. So keep in mind that the ICC has different levels. It has the prosecutor's office, which is Fatou Bensouda, and she found reason to believe that war crimes had been committed by U.S. nationals and the CIA, U.S. military and CIA officials. And then she went to the pretrial chamber. The pretrial chamber, in the meantime, between her finding that she did a preliminary examination and found that there was reason to believe that war crimes and crimes against humanity had been committed by U.S. persons. So then she asked for a full investigation with subpoenas and charges and everything. The pretrial chamber of the ICC, after hearing the threats by the Trump administration, said, okay, yes, it's true that there is evidence, there is reason to believe, but the interests of justice would not be served by launching a full investigation, a formal investigation, because we probably wouldn't get cooperation from the U.S. But the appeals chamber overruled the pretrial chamber, and a formal investigation is proceeding.
Well, even if they don't get cooperation from the United States, which they're not getting, can they indict American citizens for war crimes?
They certainly can, but whether or not they get custody, they arrest these foreign nationals, is another story. And if they do find any U.S. nationals that are indicted by the International Criminal Court in the territory of a party to the treaty, of a state party to the treaty, then they can be arrested. And then we can expect the Trump administration to use the American Servicemen's Protection Act, the Hague Invasion Act, to go in and forcibly, with armed force, extricate those people.
The ICC is known as the Court of Last Resort. It was established to hold human rights abuses accountable. Under American and international law, should the perpetrators of crimes like torture, they should have been dealt with by the U.S. government, but they weren't. And why wasn't that done?
Well, shortly after Obama was inaugurated, he said, I believe it was on CBS News, he said, generally speaking, I'm more interested in looking forward than I am in looking backwards, unquote. And his administration refused to prosecute those implicated in the torture and willful killing of detainees during the Bush administration. The Senate Intelligence Committee issued a 500-page report documenting torture, a pattern of torture and abuse, and yet Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder said he would investigate two of the most egregious incidents, and they were just horrific incidents. I won't go into the details. I've described them in some of my articles. But then he said, well, upon investigation, we don't think we could get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So you're correct. The International Criminal Court does not take the place of the national court. It works on the principle of complementarity, which means that the ICC complements the national prosecution. And if the nation, that in this case the United States, were going to take care of business and bring these people to justice who had committed torture and other war crimes and crimes against humanity in the so-called war on terror, then the ICC would not step in. And I also wanted to say, Michael, that on June 11th, this didn't get a lot of news coverage, but on June 11th, Trump declared another national emergency. He loves to declare national emergencies, which he did for the coronavirus. So he declared a national emergency, and he issued an executive order authorizing sanctions against ICC staff investigating U.S. troops and intelligence officials and those of its allies, including Israel, for possible war crimes in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And this executive order would block the financial assets of court employees and bar them and their immediate relatives from entering the United States. So the Trump administration is feeling the heat of this formal investigation that the appellate chamber of the ICC has authorized.
We're talking with Attorney Marjorie Cohn. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and we've been talking about the Trump administration's sabotaging of international law. Marjorie, before we turn our attention to another topic, let me just ask you one final question about this. What are the best and worst case scenarios with the ICC's probe into American war crimes?
Well, Michael, the best case scenario would be that after the formal investigation is completed, that the ICC prosecutor charges U.S. officials with war crimes and crimes against humanity under the Rome Statute. But the worst case scenario is if no charges are filed, or if they are filed, the U.S. refuses to cooperate. It's unlikely that U.S. persons will actually be arrested and brought to justice in The Hague, Netherlands, which is where the ICC is located. But the charges being brought against U.S. persons, whether or not they're actually prosecuted ultimately and whether or not the court actually gets jurisdiction over U.S. nationals, there will be what is called the mobilization of shame. Mobilization of shame is a real concept because people say, oh, international law doesn't have any remedies, there are no consequences. And the International Criminal Court is a criminal court, and people should be brought to justice and punished, although they don't have the death penalty for the most heinous of crimes. But the mobilization of shame means an indictment. This is an example of the mobilization of shame. An indictment of U.S. officials in the International Criminal Court will shame the United States in the eyes of the international community. We tend to be very insular here and just look at what's happening in the United States. But there is already a good deal of shame that the U.S. is suffering from internationally, and this would add to that. But whether or not U.S. officials will ever be brought to justice in front of the International Criminal Court, I'm not terribly optimistic about that.
They may not be brought to justice, but I think there's going to be some hesitation on these people to travel, say, to a place like Europe.
That's right. And there already have been. For example, and this is not necessarily the ICC, but when Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration and one of the architects of the torture program, although it mostly came from Cheney's office, I think, in conjunction with Rumsfeld, he was under investigation in Spain under universal jurisdiction, which is a doctrine where foreign countries can bring foreign nationals to justice for the most heinous of crimes. It's a well-established doctrine. The U.S. brought Adolf Eichmann to justice. Israel brought Adolf Eichmann to justice under universal jurisdiction for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they did not at the time relate to Israel directly. The U.S. has used universal jurisdiction. So Spain, during the Obama administration, was investigating Rumsfeld for torture and war crimes, and there were a few delicious months there, Michael, where Rumsfeld was afraid to travel abroad lest he be arrested. And Spain eventually backed down after back-channel pressure from the Obama administration.
No, I well remember that. Michael Ratner actually wrote a book about that. It was called The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld. Marjorie Cohn, let's turn to the domestic scene. Trump and Mitch McConnell, who controls the Senate, have so far appointed 198 judges to the federal bench. These people are mostly young, right-wingers, many of them ignorant, actually. We're going to be stuck with them for a long, long time. What harms might they commit that'll outlast the Trump presidency? Isn't the theory of American Constitution that we're supposed to have checks and balances on executive power?
Absolutely. The Constitution specifically includes three co-equal branches of government to check and balance each other, the judicial, the executive, and the legislative. And that's called separation of powers. And yet you have Trump judges who have been handpicked to be ideological, to be right-wing, radical right-wing. And unfortunately, about a quarter of the federal appeals court judges have been appointed by Trump. And these are lifetime appointments, and most cases are handled at the Court of Appeals level. They don't get to the Supreme Court. So they can certainly do a lot of damage. In fact, where Trump judges have voted in the lower courts, they have ruled or tried to rule in every case to sustain restrictions on abortion. That's an example.
There are a number of examples I'll share with you. Unleashing corporate power, laws protecting the environment, discrimination, police abuse, laws that would restrict presidential power, which leads me to this overarching question. What ideology motivates these Trump judges? They're mostly members of the Federalist Society. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, two radical right-wing organizations, really set up to remake the judiciary and move it to the right. And they came up with a list of acceptable right-wing judges. And all of Trump's appointments, all of his nominations, including his Supreme Court nominations and his lower federal court nominations, came off of that list, which means that they have passed the ideological litmus test for being radical right-wingers. And quite frankly, Michael, we have a very closely balanced Supreme Court, and we've seen that in some of the decisions that have come down. But if Trump is reelected, and this is probably the most important reason to vote against him, I know that Biden is not a great candidate for many, many reasons. I don't care for him myself. But if Trump is reelected, he will remake the Supreme Court for decades to come. He well may create a 7-2 right-wing majority on the Supreme Court for 40-plus years, and that's very, very disturbing because, as you ticked off, there are many issues that come before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is makes the law of the land, and that will affect all of our rights ultimately. So it's very, very worrisome.
Bill Barr, in my estimation, is a bad guy. The Attorney General's office is supposed to uphold the Constitution and be independent. What has Bill Barr been doing lately that undermines that role?
Well, it's interesting, Michael, because in January of 2019, I wrote an article called William Barr Will Be a Loyal Foot Soldier in King Trump's Army. I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. It was clear from the beginning. He likely came to Trump's attention after writing an unsolicited 19-page memo in June of 2018 criticizing the Mueller probe and claiming that the president has total control over the executive branch. He said, and this is what Bill Barr said in this memo, he said the president has authority over all law enforcement, including matters involving his own conduct and those in which he has a personal stake. So he made sure that the Mueller report was buried. He falsely said that Barr had exonerated Donald Trump of obstruction of justice, which was a lie. And Barr has recently come under criticism. He fired Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, who had prosecuted Michael Cohen, and he was investigating Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. And also, and Giuliani received favorable treatment because of his relationship with Trump, according to a former prosecutor who will testify. The Democrats in the Judiciary Committee convened a hearing, the House Judiciary Committee convened a hearing to hear from two Department of Justice officials, whistleblowers, who are expected to testify about how the agency became politicized under Barr and Trump. And Barr has agreed to testify before the House Judiciary Committee for a general oversight hearing on July 28th. One of the things that the Democrats want to investigate is the Department of, and keep in mind the Attorney General runs the Department of Justice. He's the top cop in the country. He's not supposed to be Trump's personal lawyer. He's supposed to be the lawyer of the whole United States. The Department of Justice's handling of cases regarding Trump's friends and allies like Roger Stone. Roger Stone received favorable treatment because of his relationship with Trump. Again, the former prosecutor will testify to. And also, the Democrats want to get at Barr's role in clearing the peaceful protesters outside the White House so Trump could do a photo op in front of an historic church. And there was a peaceful protest going on outside the White House, in support of Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives. In order for Trump to walk across the street and go do this photo op in front of the church, holding up a Bible, which I'm sure he's never read, holding it upside down. It reminds me of Bush holding that book upside down when he was... But what they did was to use chemical weapons against these protesters, tear gas and other kinds of chemical weapons to disperse a peaceful crowd exercising their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and freedom of assembly so that Trump could do his cynical photo op. So that's also something that the Democrats in the House want to investigate.
You know, what struck me was that Berman, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, is a Republican. He was a big financial contributor to Trump. He had some integrity, and they got rid of him. They were able to get rid of him. He made a deal. He said, I'll leave peaceably, but I want to appoint my assistant. I want you to appoint her to replace me, and they've done that. So far, let's see whether she continues the probes. I think they were looking into Rudy Giuliani and then a couple of lawyers associated with Giuliani. But where do you think it's going?
Well, it's unclear, but there will be public hearings, which will be very revealing. And by the way, Barr announced that Berman had resigned. Berman said, I didn't resign, and so he was actually fired. And then it turns out that Trump gave the order, although Trump denied any knowledge of it. You know, he lies pathologically. So we'll see what happens, but I assume that these hearings will be televised, and I think that that will be very revealing for the American public, especially as we get closer to the election. My understanding is that at this point, Biden is leading Trump by 14 points. Of course, who knows how accurate the polls are, but Trump is really he's squirming, and he's upset, and he's worried, and who knows what he'll do. We're going to talk a little bit later about his use of military force or his threat to use military force against protesters.
I've been following those polls like you have, Marjorie, and it's clear that the wheels are coming off the bus. Biden is sequestered, not doing very much, and nonetheless is rising in popularity compared to Trump because of Trump's mismanagement of the health crisis and the economic crisis. But what's interesting is that the military, Trump used to brag about, he's got the military, the police, and the bikers on his side. And lately we've seen the military peel away from Trump. If Trump thought that he could stay in office beyond November, he should give that a second thought. I remember when Michael Cohen was testifying, Michael Cohen was Trump's fixer and a personal attorney. He was testifying before Congress, and the last question they asked him was about Trump, and Cohen said, he's never going to leave office peaceably, and that's something that we should all remember. But let's turn our attention to that topic, Marjorie Cohen. I'd like to speak to you about Trump's using the military 2 weeks ago in Washington against peaceful protesters. Why was Trump's show of force 2 weeks ago in Lafayette Park illegal?
Well, this is just going to take a bit of explanation, Michael. Members of the military have a duty under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to obey lawful orders. And the Article 92 says a general order or regulation is lawful unless it is contrary to the Constitution or the law or the laws of the United States. So a law that violates the Constitution or a federal statute is an unlawful order, and both the Army Field Manual and the Nuremberg Principles create a duty to disobey unlawful orders. Retired Navy Admiral Mike Mullen, also former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wrote in The Atlantic that members of the military will obey lawful orders, quote, but I am less confident in the soundness of the orders they will be given by this commander-in-chief, and I am not convinced that the conditions on our streets, as bad as they are, have risen to the level that justifies a heavy reliance on military troops. Now, using federal troops for civilian law enforcement violates the Posse Comitatus Act, but the Insurrection Act contains an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. So there are four ways to trigger the Insurrection Act to deploy the military on U.S. soil. First of all, when the legislature or a governor of a state asks the president for assistance, and that has not happened here. In fact, when Trump has threatened the governors, they have really lashed back. The second, and this is the one that Trump would likely use under the Insurrection Act, when the president considers that unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages, or rebellion against the authority of the United States make it impracticable, that means impractical, to enforce the laws of the United States in any state by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Now, that section, and the other two would not apply, the other two sections, but that section is triggered by the president's subjective belief when he considers that these things are unlawful. So that requires him to find that it is impracticable for the courts and criminal legal system to work properly. That threshold has not been met in the current situation, and although courts would be unlikely to overrule the president's subjective decision, service members may well decide that his order was illegal and refuse to obey it. And the Veterans for Peace, I'm on the board of Veterans for Peace, called on all current National Guard members to lay down their weapons. Many of them have gone AWOL. Many of them are asking Veterans for Peace, the GI Rights Hotline, the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force for advice on their rights in the event that Trump decides to bring back this military force and even use it in the United States.
What was it that forced Trump to withdraw the troops from D.C.?
Well, there was a backlash by members, by 89 former defense officials, generals, and Congress members. There was such an outcry, and it was all over the media, that Trump backed down and removed the troops. But he says, now that everything is under perfect control, as if he was the one who got it under perfect control by bringing those troops. He says, but they can return quickly if needed. So there's that threat. And on June the 4th, he said all options are on the table. So he's kind of holding this as a cudgel over our heads.
Yeah, but he's got to be thinking, if I try it again and I get resistance, I could be even worse shape. Can you review for us what it was that caused Trump to order the military to go into D.C. in the first place?
What caused him, I think it was when there was property damage and looting, and he started freaking out. And also because of the huge numbers of people, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were in the streets, not just in Washington, D.C., but all over the country in all 50 states. So about 1,600 troops from Fort Bragg and Fort Drum began arriving in Washington on June the 1st, and apparently Trump wanted 10,000 active duty troops dispatched throughout the country, but his Defense Secretary Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Milley, reportedly talked him out of it. The military is not trained in peacekeeping or de-escalation. They're trained to use lethal force, often employed against civilians in foreign countries. And now they are being ordered to suppress peaceful protests in the U.S., protesters who are exercising their First Amendment rights of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. But also on June the 1st, the Pentagon used Army National Guard helicopters as a show of force usually reserved for combat zones. Two helicopters flew low over protesters, sending them running for cover and tearing posters from the sides of buildings. And they were supposed to be what's called a persistent presence, whatever that means, because pilots were given no guidance, were basically forced to wing it. And the wind speeds created by a low hovering helicopter can lift objects and cause serious damage, even injury or death, according to a Human Rights Watch report.
Trump was pressured into withdrawing the troops. Where did the pressure come from?
Well, it came from a number of places, including Congress members, but these 89 former defense officials issued a statement on June the 5th, and they said, "We are alarmed at how the president is betraying his oath to support and defend the Constitution by threatening to order members of the U.S. military to violate the rights of their fellow Americans." And they wrote that Trump gave the governors of the states a stark choice: either end the protests that continue to demand equal justice under our laws, or expect that he will send active duty military units into their states. And they called on Trump to immediately end his plans to send active duty military personnel into cities as agents of law enforcement, or to employ them or any other military or police forces in ways that undermine the constitutional rights of Americans. And shortly after that, I think 2 days later, he withdrew the troops.
Yeah, I think that he was losing popularity in the military when he pardoned Ed Garrity, the Navy SEAL, who killed a teenager with his own knife, and the Navy SEAL's own men turned him in. Trump reversed the decision and reinstalled him as a Navy SEAL. And the windup of that was the Secretary of the Navy got fired for opposing what Trump did. So I think going all the way back to then, the military, I mean, of all things, the military was opposing Trump. Marjorie Cohen, can Trump call out troops in the future, like over the summer if the COVID situation worsens, or in November if he loses the election?
Well, on March the 13th, Friday the 13th, Trump declared a national emergency because of the COVID-19 situation, and he invoked laws that trigger more than 100 additional powers for the president, and they include the authority to shut down radio stations, freeze bank accounts, and even deploy the military. And he can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communication, and that probably includes television, radio, and the internet. And I think that you interviewed constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde on WBAI Law and Disorder, your show. You and Heidi Boghossian interviewed him, and he was very alarmed at that. And Trump, as I said, he declared that national emergency. He declared a national emergency because the ICC is investigating U.S. nationals for war crimes, some kind of national emergency, right? Yeah. And the protests will continue. I am confident, and I would not be surprised if we see him declare another national emergency as things heat up and as we get closer to the election. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he declares martial law and cancels the election, although it would be unconstitutional under the 22nd Amendment. But all bets are off as Trump continues to get more and more freaked out by his falling poll numbers and resistance. And you're right, his mishandling, his denial and mishandling, criminal mishandling of the pandemic and the consequential economic downturn, and his tin ear, and that's putting it nicely, his racist response to these overwhelming protests in support of the movement for Black Lives. And all of that, I think, is causing his numbers to plummet, his poll numbers to plummet. But who knows what he's capable of?
Under our law, elections are governed by the states, aren't they? Why would Trump have any say-so in declaring an election illegitimate?
He wouldn't. He wouldn't. Absolutely not. It would violate the 22nd Amendment. But will he try? I mean, he tries to do all kinds of things that are illegal. I don't know. Now, I've also heard something, and I'm not sure how true it is, that he's, as his poll numbers fall, he really doesn't want to be reelected deep down in his heart of hearts. He did do an interview, a media interview with his son, Donald Jr., and there's some speculation that that's really what he wanted in the first place. He didn't really think he would be elected president. He wanted to set himself up to start a media company, like Fox or in opposition to Fox, besides Fox.
If the scenario unfolds in a dark way like we've just been talking about, what can we do about it?
Well, people are, protesting in the streets. There are mass demonstrations, exercising their First Amendment rights. That will continue, should continue, especially if Trump assumes powers that he doesn't have to hold on to power. And also pressure Congress. Congress legislators do respond to pressure. So that means emailing, calling, texting, signing petitions, sitting in congresspersons' offices, and generally applying pressure to the legislature to check and balance an out-of-control executive. And writing op-eds, writing letters to the editor, doing shows like yours. Letters to the editor, by the way, are not hard to get published. Keep them under 150 words, peg them to a news story or an opinion piece, and even if your letter doesn't get published, they count up how many letters there are from each perspective. And so your letter, even if it's not published, will help other letters from a similar perspective be published. And I just think generally we have to keep the pressure on.
Last question, Attorney Marjorie Cohen. How can people learn more about your work?
My articles and video and radio interviews and descriptions of my books are collected on my website, www.marjoriecohn.com, MarjorieCohn.com.
Marjorie Cohn, it's just been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your knowledge and your preparation and your stamina in holding up for a 55-minute interview. Very grateful, and it's just terrific to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks so much for inviting me.
You take it easy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.